Hey everyone, and welcome back for another deep dive. Today we're going to be exploring the world of ancient Israelite prophets.
Oh, yeah.
But not the ones you're probably thinking of. You know,
Right.
those lone figures we typically imagine out there in the wilderness delivering pronouncements.
Yeah.
This time we're diving into something a little different.
Okay.
Something called Companies of the Prophets.
Companies of the Prophets. Interesting.
Yeah, think like ancient prophet collectives.
Huh. Okay. Like a whole group?
Yeah, like a whole group, and it really challenges how we normally think of prophets, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I always picture them as kind of solitary figures,
Exactly.
delivering their pronouncements in isolation.
Yeah.
But it seems like the historical reality might be a lot more complex than that.
Yeah, a lot more complex and interconnected. And to
Interesting.
guide our deep dive today, we have this really great lecture from biblical scholar Robert Vinoy.
Okay.
He really unpacks the mystery surrounding these prophet groups.
Okay.
And trust me, there's a lot to unpack.
All right, I'm ready.
We're talking prophet communes, possible prophet schools,
Prophet schools.
even this unsettling idea of prophets for profit.
Prophets for profit. Now that's something I haven't heard before.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. It really makes you question
Yeah.
some of our assumptions about prophecy and how it functioned back
For
then.
sure, for sure.
So let's start with the basics.
Okay.
What does this term "sons of the prophets" actually mean?
Okay.
Because it sounds a bit like, a family business.
Yeah,
Like,
right.
we've got the prophets, and then their sons are taking
Yeah,
over.
right.
But Vinoy points out that it could be a little misleading.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he says that sons of, in this context, doesn't necessarily refer to, like, literal offspring,
Okay.
but instead think of it more like a descriptive term for a group or a guild.
Like a group label.
Yeah, exactly, like a group label,
Okay.
like how we might say Sons of Liberty or Sons of Anarchy today.
Oh, I see. So it's more about belonging to a particular group or movement.
Exactly.
Okay, so not like a family band of prophets or anything.
No, not a family band.
Okay.
And Vinoy uses some really good examples from the Bible to illustrate this.
Oh, okay. Let's hear it.
So, for example, he points to Nehemiah 12:28,
Okay.
where it talks about the sons of the singers.
Okay.
And obviously that's referring to members of a choir.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So not a literal family of singers.
Right. Just a group.
Just a group, yeah.
A choir.
So maybe think of it more like a prophet chorus
Interesting.
instead of like a family band.
Okay.
And there are other examples too, like in Psalm 18:44,
Okay.
you have the phrase sons of strangers,
Sons of
which
strangers.
again obviously doesn't mean literal children of foreigners.
Right.
It just signifies foreigners as a group.
Okay, so it's a way of designating a collective.
Exactly, a collective, a group.
Right, I think I'm starting to get it.
Okay, good. Got
So
it.
Sons of the Prophets are basically just a group of prophets.
Exactly, that's it.
But what did this collective actually look like? Like, how organized were they?
Yeah, were they structured? Were there leaders? Were they followers?
And what about training? Was there anything like a formal school for prophets?
That's what we're going to get into next.
Ooh, okay, I'm all ears.
Because that's where things get really interesting.
Oh, okay.
This idea of a school of the prophets,
Right.
it's popular.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that before.
Yeah, a lot of people think that's what was going on. But Vinoy says
Yeah.
that it's actually more of a myth
A myth, really?
than a historical reality.
Huh.
And he points out that the term itself, school of the prophets,
Right.
never appears in the Bible.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But what about those passages where you see figures like Samuel and Elisha?
Yeah.
Like, they seem to be leading groups of prophets. So,
Sure.
weren't they acting as teachers or mentors in some way?
Yeah, that's a good question. And there's definitely a degree of ambiguity
Yeah.
surrounding their roles. But like you mentioned, 1 Samuel 19:20,
Right.
that mentions Samuel as a leader, but it doesn't explicitly say that he's teaching.
Okay.
And then similarly, in 2 Kings 4:38, you have Elisha,
Okay.
who provides food for a group of prophets during a famine.
So they were eating together.
Yeah, communal eating
Okay.
in times of hardship.
But that doesn't necessarily mean they were a school,
Right.
right? It could
Right.
just be like helping each other out, like a
Exact.
community support system.
Right. And it's easy to impose our modern ideas of, organized education
Right.
onto these ancient groups.
Yeah, with classroom and curriculum and all.
Exactly. But the evidence just doesn't support that.
Huh. Okay, so no prophet school.
Yeah. And especially when you look at the major prophets like Amos,
Yeah.
they receive their callings directly from God,
Right.
not from some, prophetic academy.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess if you're getting a message straight from God, you don't really need to go to school for it.
Right, exactly.
So, okay, we've debunked the prophet school myth,
Debunked.
but what about their living arrangements?
Yeah.
Did they all live together in some kind of ancient commune?
Now, that's a question that leads us into some fascinating and sometimes conflicting evidence.
Ooh, I love a good biblical mystery.
I know, me too.
Lay it on me.
All right, so on one hand, we have passages like the one we just talked about in 2 Kings 4.38.
Right, with the communal eating.
Uh-huh, suggesting some sort of communal living.
Right.
But then we also encounter stories like the prophet's widow.
Okay.
In 2 Kings 4.1-7,
okay.
Who seems to have her own house.
Her own house.
Yeah.
So like a separate dwelling.
Exactly.
Interesting. So we've got evidence pointing in both directions.
Both directions, communal living and individual dwellings.
Yeah.
And then there's this mysterious place called Naioth.
Naioth.
Yeah, that's mentioned in 1 Samuel 19.
Okay.
Where David seeks refuge with Samuel.
Okay.
And it's not entirely clear what Naioth was, but some scholars think it might have been some kind of prophet community.
Okay.
Maybe with individual homes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so not like a secluded, you know, monastery or anything.
Right, right. Like a more integrated community.
Exactly.
Huh. That really makes you wonder what daily life was like for these companies of the prophets.
I know, right? Like, were they just constantly having these prophetic visions?
Or did they have regular jobs and routines like everyone else?
Yeah. Did they go grocery shopping?
Did they have hobbies?
Did they, you know, complain about the weather?
Right, right. Like, what was their day-to-day like?
It's a great question, and it kind of leads us to another important question.
Okay.
Was it all, you know, divine inspiration and righteous living?
Right.
Or did things get a little murky?
Murky.
Within these groups over time?
Oh, I see what you're getting at.
Yeah, did they always stay true to their calling?
Or did power and influence corrupt them?
Ooh, I sense some drama brewing.
I know, right? Tell me more.
All right, so let's explore this idea.
Okay.
Of the degeneration of the prophetic function.
Degeneration?
Yeah, it seems like with a lot of things, you know, power and personal gain.
Yeah.
Might have corrupted some of these groups.
Right. So not all prophets were created equal.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so where do we see this corruption playing out?
Well, think of Ahab's 400 prophets.
Oh, yeah.
In 1 Kings 22.
Okay.
They basically told him exactly what he wanted to hear.
Oh, so they were like yes men.
Yeah.
Just telling the king what he wanted to hear.
Exactly. Even if it wasn't the true message from God.
Not exactly speaking truth to power, are they?
Not really, no.
More like prophets for profit.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Exactly. And then there's this really chilling line from Micah 3.5.
Oh, Micah.
Yeah.
What's it say?
It says, "As for the prophets who lead my people astray, if one feeds them, they proclaim peace. If he does not, they prepare to wage war against him."
Wow, that's pretty intense.
Yeah, so it suggests that some prophets might have been prioritizing their own comfort.
Right, their own security.
Exactly.
Over delivering God's message faithfully.
Yeah, so not exactly a shining example of prophetic integrity.
No, not at all. It's like they were more interested in what was in it for them than speaking truth to power.
Yeah, and this really raises the question of, you know, were all these prophet companies like this?
Right. Were they all corrupt, or were there some that stayed true to their calling?
It's a good question, and it's hard to say for sure based on the evidence we have.
Right.
But it does seem like there was a real spectrum of, you know, integrity within these groups.
Okay, so we've got this whole spectrum of prophets from the super righteous to the downright corrupt.
Yeah, exactly.
But where do the major and minor prophets fit into all of this? The ones whose books we have in the Bible?
Yeah, were they part of these prophet companies too?
That's what I'm wondering.
Well, that's a crucial distinction to make.
Okay.
Because there's actually no evidence suggesting that the canonical prophets were ever part of these companies.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in fact, they seem to have operated quite differently.
In what way?
Well, for one thing, they seem to have received their messages directly from God.
Okay.
And they didn't rely on prophecy as a source of income.
So they weren't professional prophets in that sense.
Right, exactly. They weren't doing it for the money.
Interesting.
Yeah, and a good example of this can be found in Amos 7.
Amos.
Where you have this priest named Amaziah.
Okay.
Who confronts Amos and tells him to go back to Judah and earn his bread by prophesying there.
But basically saying, go back where you came from and make a living doing your prophet thing somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. And it sounds like he's implying that Amos is just in it for the money.
Right, like he's just a prophet for profit.
Exactly. And Amos's response is really key.
Okay, what does he say?
He says, "I was neither a prophet nor a prophet's son, but I was a shepherd, and I took care of sycamore fig trees."
So he's saying, prophecy isn't my job. I have my own livelihood, and I'm doing this because I'm called to, not because I'm getting paid.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
That's a powerful statement.
Yeah, and it really highlights the difference between him
and
those who might be, you know, prophets for profit.
Yeah, those who are just doing it for the money.
Yeah. And Vinod points out something really interesting about this passage.
Okay.
He says that the way it's translated can actually change the meaning.
Oh, really?
Significantly.
How so?
Well, it all comes down to a missing verb.
A missing verb.
Yeah, in the Hebrew text.
Okay.
And because of that, the line can be translated in either the past or present tense.
Oh, I see. And that can make a big difference in meaning.
Yeah, a world of difference.
Okay, I'm hooked. Break it down for me. How does the tense change things?
All right, so if we use the past tense,
okay,
I was neither a prophet.
Okay.
Then Amos is simply stating that he wasn't a prophet.
Right.
Before God called him.
Right. So it's like a before and after situation.
Exactly.
He was a shepherd and then he became a prophet.
Right.
Okay. But what happens if we translate it in the present tense?
If we say, I am neither a prophet.
Okay.
Then it becomes a much bolder statement.
Oh, really?
About the nature of prophecy itself.
Okay. I'm intrigued.
Because in the present tense,
yeah,
Amos is rejecting the idea,
okay,
of prophecy as a profession.
Oh, so he's saying it's not a job you can just do for money.
Exactly. He's drawing a clear line between himself,
right,
and those who might be, you know, prophets for profit.
Wow, that's a powerful distinction.
Yeah, it really is.
And it makes you wonder if that debate over, you know, the professionalization of prophecy,
yeah,
is still relevant today.
Right. Are there modern day parallels we could draw?
Yeah. Are there people claiming to speak for a higher power?
Right.
But who are really just in it for the money or the fame?
Exactly.
That's something worth thinking about for sure.
Absolutely.
But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, there's another crucial point about how these canonical prophets,
yeah,
differed from those prophet companies.
Okay.
And it has to do with the purpose and function of prophecy itself.
Yeah, because when most people hear the word prophet,
right,
they immediately think of, you know, predicting the future.
Right, like fortune tellers.
Exactly.
But you're saying it's more than that?
Yeah, much more than that.
Okay, so if they weren't just predicting the future,
yeah,
what was the core of their message? What were they trying to communicate?
So at its heart, their role was to speak God's message to the people.
Okay.
Often focusing on themes of repentance.
Okay.
And covenant faithfulness.
So less about peering into a crystal ball.
Yeah.
And more about calling people back to God.
Exactly.
Holding them accountable for their actions.
Yeah. Think of them more as preachers or social commentators.
Okay.
Than, you know, mystical oracles.
So they were challenging the status quo.
Yeah.
Calling out injustice.
Uh-huh.
Reminding people of their obligations to God.
And to each other.
Right. It's about living in the present.
Yeah.
Not just obsessing over the future.
Exactly.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
And this is where the various titles used for prophets become really interesting.
Okay. How so?
Well, we've talked about man of God and servant of the Lord,
right,
but Vano also highlights terms like messenger of the Lord.
Messenger of the Lord.
Yeah. And each one of these reveals a different facet of their relationship with God.
Okay.
And their role in communicating his message.
So it's like each title adds another layer to our understanding of what it meant to be a prophet.
Exactly. Exactly.
But were there any similarities at all between those canonical prophets and those companies of the prophets we discussed earlier?
Yeah.
Or were they completely separate entities?
That's a great question. And I think while their methods and motivations might have differed,
right,
there were some fundamental aspects of their roles,
yeah,
that overlapped.
Like what?
Well, both groups were engaged in religious activities.
Okay.
And they were both seeking to guide and influence the people of Israel.
So in a sense, they were both trying to connect people with the divine.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if they went about it in different ways.
Exactly.
Okay, that's interesting.
And they both faced this challenge,
yeah,
of discerning true messages from God.
Right.
From those that might have been influenced by personal ambition or political pressure.
That's a struggle that continues to this day, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
How do we know when someone is genuinely speaking for God?
Yeah.
Or just using religion for their own gain?
It's a huge question.
It is.
It's a question for the ages.
It is, and it's something we'll definitely have to explore further.
Yeah, we'll definitely come back to that.
But for now, let's circle back to those companies of the prophets one last time.
Okay.
What stands out to you as the most intriguing or perplexing aspect of their existence?
You know, I think for me, it's the lack of clarity.
Yeah.
Around their purpose and structure.
Right. Like, what were they actually trying to achieve?
Exactly. Were they more like spiritual support groups?
Okay.
Were they social movements?
Yeah.
Were they something else entirely?
I've got all these clues, but no clear answers.
Right. And Vinoy presents some compelling evidence.
Yeah.
But he leaves us with more questions than answers.
It's like a puzzle with some missing pieces.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's that whole issue of their potential decline into corruption.
Right, right.
It really makes you think about how power can corrupt even the most well-intentioned groups.
Absolutely.
And how important it is to be discerning.
Yes.
About who we listen to and who we trust.
And that's a great point to transition into the next part of our conversation.
Okay.
Because we're going to be talking more about,
yeah,
the challenges of discerning true processing,
okay,
from false processing.
Like, right, I'm ready.
And how to apply those lessons to our lives today.
Sounds good to me.
So stay tuned, folks.
Can't wait.
We'll be right back after a short break.
All right. You see, most people, when they think about prophets, they think about predicting the future.
Right, like fortune tellers.
Yeah, exactly. But the reality is a lot more nuanced than that.
So if it's not all about, you know, seeing what's to come,
yeah.
What was the core of their message then? What were they actually trying to say?
Well, at its heart, prophecy was about speaking God's message to the people.
Okay.
It was about reminding them of God's character,
okay.
His desires,
uh-huh.
And his expectations for how they should live their lives.
So less about, you know, predicting specific events.
Yeah.
And more about, like, calling people back to God.
Exactly.
And holding them accountable for their actions.
Think of them more as creatures.
Okay.
And social commentators than mystical oracles.
So they were challenging the status quo.
Yeah.
Calling out injustice.
Uh-huh. Reminding people of their obligations to God and to each other.
Right. It's about living in the present.
Exactly.
Not just, you know, obsessing over the future.
And this is where all the different titles used for prophets become really interesting.
Oh, okay. How so?
Well, we've talked about man of God
right.
And servant of the Lord.
Right.
But Vinoy also points out terms like messenger of the Lord.
Messenger of the Lord.
And each of these titles gives us a slightly different perspective.
Okay.
On the prophet's relationship with God and their role in communicating his message.
It's like each one adds a little piece to the puzzle.
Precisely.
Okay.
And then there's the Hebrew word nabi.
Nabi.
Which is actually the most common term.
Okay.
Used for prophets in the Bible.
Interesting.
And what's interesting is that this word didn't have the same connotations.
Okay.
As soothsayers or diviners.
Oh, so they weren't just like reading omens.
No, not at all.
Or like consulting crystal balls.
Not in the same way that you might find in other ancient cultures.
So how is it different?
Well, the Greek translation of nabi is prophetes,
okay.
Which is where we get our English word prophet.
Right.
But even in the Greek context,
yep.
Prophetes had a very specific mean.
Okay, what was that?
Think about the Delphic oracle.
Oh, yeah.
You know the one with the priestess?
Yeah, the Pythia?
Yes, the Pythia.
And those super cryptic pronouncements?
Exactly. She would deliver these pronouncements supposedly from the god Apollo.
Right.
But they were often so cryptic
yeah.
That you needed a prophet's. To interpret them.
Oh, so the prophets was like the translator.
Yeah, like a bridge between the divine and the human.
Trying to make sense of all the mystical mumbo jumbo.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay.
And this distinction is crucial when we're trying to understand the biblical concept of a prophet.
Okay.
It wasn't about conjuring up visions.
Right.
Or predicting the future.
It was about communicating a message.
Exactly.
That people could actually understand.
Yes, in a way that was relevant to their lives.
Okay, that makes sense.
And this brings us back to the etymology of the word nabi itself.
Okay.
There's some debate about its exact origins.
Uh-huh.
But some scholars suggest that it comes from the Akkadian word nabu.
Nabu.
Which means to speak or to call.
So a prophet is someone who's called by God to speak.
That's one interpretation. Others argue that it's actually a passive form
okay.
Of nabu, meaning one who is called by God.
Oh, so the emphasis is on the being called.
Exactly.
Okay.
Either way, it highlights this idea
yeah.
Of divine selection.
Okay.
That not just anyone could be a prophet.
It was a calling.
It was a responsibility
okay.
Entrusted to specific individuals.
Now, we've talked a lot about the differences between these canonical prophets and those companies of the prophets.
Yeah.
But were there any similarities at all? Like, did they share any common ground?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
And while their methods and motivations might have differed,
right.
I think there were some fundamental aspects of their roles that did overlap.
Like what?
Well, both groups were engaged in religious activities.
Okay.
And they were both seeking to guide and influence the people of Israel.
So in a sense, they were both trying to connect people with the divine.
Yeah.
Even if they went about it in different ways.
Exactly. Like different approaches to the same spiritual quest.
Right. And they both face this challenge
uh-huh.
Of discerning true messages from God
right.
From those that might have been influenced by personal ambition or political pressure.
It's a struggle that resonates throughout history, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
How do we know when someone is genuinely speaking for God?
Right.
Or just using religion for their own gain?
It's a question for the ages.
It is a question for the ages, and it's something we should definitely explore further.
We should, and we will.
But for now, let's circle back to those companies of the prophets one last time.
Okay.
What stands out to you as the most intriguing or perplexing aspect of their existence?
I think what really gets me is the lack of clarity
yeah.
Around their purpose and structure.
What were they actually trying to achieve?
Exactly. Like, were they more like spiritual support groups?
Okay.
Were they social movements?
Mm-hmm.
Were they something else entirely?
We got all these clues, but it's hard to put them together.
Right. Vinoy gives us some compelling evidence, but he leaves us with more questions than answers.
It's like a puzzle with some missing pieces.
Exactly. And then there's the whole issue of their potential decline into corruption. It makes you think about how power can corrupt even the most well-intentioned groups.
And how important it is to be discerning.
Yes.
About who we listen to and who we trust.
That's a great point. And it actually leads us perfectly into the next part of our conversation.
Oh, okay.
Because we're going to be talking more about the challenges of discerning
yeah.
true prophecy from false prophecy.
All right, I'm ready for it.
And how to apply those lessons to our lives today.
Let's do it. And it makes you wonder if, you know, if there are like modern day parallels.
Oh, yeah.
Are there figures today who might fit this description of a prophet?
Right.
Not necessarily like predicting the future.
Right.
But speaking truth to power and challenging the status quo.
Yeah, it's an interesting question to think about, like, who are the prophets of our time?
Right.
You know, and I think there are a lot of people who might fit that description
yeah.
in different ways, you know.
For sure.
Like activists, mm-hmm. whistleblowers,
mm-hmm.
artists who use their platforms to address, you know, social injustices.
I think those are all good examples.
Yeah, and they might not claim like direct divine inspiration.
Right.
But they often embody that prophetic spirit, you know,
yeah.
of challenging norms and speaking truth to power.
It's a good point.
Yeah. And it's a reminder that prophecy might take many forms.
Yeah.
And that it's maybe more relevant today mm-hmm. than we often realize.
For sure.
But let's not lose sight of those ancient companies of prophets.
Right.
You know, we've been digging into their lives and their roles.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, what stands out to you as the most intriguing or perplexing aspect?
Well, what really strikes me
yeah.
is the paradoxical nature of these groups.
Okay.
On the one hand, we see evidence of structure and organization.
Right.
But then on the other hand, there's this element of spontaneity and, you know, individual expression.
Yeah.
It's this blend of contradictions that makes them so fascinating.
Yeah. It's like they were trying to find this balance.
Right.
Between communal identity.
Yeah.
And personal revelation.
Right.
Between tradition and innovation.
Exactly. And I imagine that tension played out in all sorts of interesting ways.
I know, right?
Like, were there arguments and disagreements within these groups?
Yeah, were there, like, rival prophets?
Yeah.
You know, different factions vying for influence?
Right.
And were there moments of, you know, ecstatic inspiration?
Yeah.
And then periods of doubt and questioning?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not hard to imagine all of these things happening.
No, not at all. It was a dynamic and evolving community.
And that brings us back to like the heart of prophecy itself.
Right.
You know, we've been talking about how it wasn't talked about predicting the future.
Yeah.
But if it wasn't about fortune telling,
yeah.
what was it really about?
What was the core message
yeah.
that these prophets were trying to convey?
Both, you know, the canonical prophets and those in these companies.
Right.
What are they trying to say?
Well, I think at its essence,
yeah.
prophecy was about connecting people with the divine.
Okay.
It was about reminding them.
Uh-huh.
of God's character, oh, no. his desires,
right.
and his expectations for how they should live their lives.
So it was about, you know, aligning yourself with God's will.
Exactly.
Not just knowing what's going to happen.
It was about living in the present moment.
Yeah.
And making choices
mm-hmm.
that reflected God's values.
Okay.
Both individually and as a community.
And that often involved, like, challenging the status quo.
Right.
Calling out hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Being truth to power.
Yeah. Even when it was difficult or dangerous.
Yeah. Exactly.
That takes a lot of courage.
Right.
A lot of conviction.
Yeah.
A deep sense of calling.
Yeah. And it makes you wonder how these prophets navigated all of that.
Yeah. How did they discern God's voice amidst all the noise and distractions?
Yeah. How did they know they were on the right path?
And I think those are questions that
yeah.
we can all relate to.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Like, how do we know what's truly important?
Right.
You know, what's aligned with our deepest values? How do we find our own prophetic voice
right.
in a world that's constantly trying to pull us
yeah.
in different directions?
And I think that's a really powerful takeaway
yeah.
from this whole conversation.
I agree.
It's not just about, you know, understanding ancient history.
Right.
It's about reflecting on our own lives.
Yeah.
And how we choose to respond to the challenges and opportunities
yeah.
that we face.
Well said.
So this has been a really enriching exploration.
Yeah, it has.
Of the companies of prophets.
Lots to think about.
You know, from their mysterious origins and structure.
Right.
To their complex role in communicating divine messages.
Yeah.
It's a topic that's really sparked our curiosity.
For sure.
And I think left us with a lot to ponder.
And I hope it's inspired our listeners to do some exploring of their own.
Yeah.
To delve deeper into these ancient texts.
Yeah.
And to see what insights and connections they might discover.
Exactly.
So to everyone listening,
yeah.
I encourage you to keep exploring.
Keep questioning.
And keep seeking truth.
And if you have any thoughts or insights or even, you know, aha moments along the way.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear them.
Share them with us.
Yeah, because the journey of discovery is always more rewarding when it's shared.
Well, until next time,
yeah.
May you find inspiration in the stories of these prophets.
Yeah.
And the courage to live out your own calling
yes.
in the world.
Beautifully said. Thanks for joining us, everyone.